You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Matthew Taylor. Welcome to the RSA Thursday event. We've got a brilliant panel to discuss the issue of Brexit 1 year on. Tomorrow will be exactly a year since the Brexit referendum. And although the political landscape has changed significantly, that's a great understatement, much is still unclear. Article 50 has been triggered. Theresa May, as we know, lost her gamble to get a bigger majority to drive Brexit through. 2 days ago, David Davis and the UK negotiating team travelled to Brussels to begin the official wrangling in earnest. So, with so much to play for, so many questions still outstanding, so much heat, perhaps not nearly as much light, we thought it would be a good idea to bring people together to discuss this particular moment and where things might go from here. We have a wonderful team to guide us through this complicated terrain. We have Arnaud Menon, who's Professor of European Politics and Foreign Affairs at King's College London, Director of the UK in a Changing Europe Initiative. And you're responsible for this, aren't you?
Well, kind of. Yeah. I wrote the foreword.
Yeah. Well, it's very, very good. It's available online, presumably. But you're going to wave your own copy around, aren't you?
Yes.
Gina Miller, founder of the True and Fair Foundation, instigator of the momentous legal case against the government for attempting a Brexit without parliamentary approval. Hi, Gina. And Jonathan Isaby, editor of Brexit Central, an online forum which aims to provide coverage of Brexit negotiations and hold the government to account in making sure Brexit means Brexit. So, first of all, Arnaud.
Thank you very much. Hi, everyone. What I was asked to do was just sort of set the scene and just reflect very briefly on where we are 1 year on. And I'm struck thinking about that question by two things. A year on, we still are profoundly in the dark about what Brexit is going to look like when we get to the end of this process. I mean, there are a few things we know. We know that the Prime Minister and her team seem committed to the sort of Brexit that she was talking about even before the general election. There are no signs, whatever the sort of subtle hints about Philip Hammond as yet, that anything has changed in the leaving the single market, leaving the customs union. We know that the civil service has done an amazing, an enormous amount of background work to prepare the negotiations. We're not yet fully certain that ministers are listening to what they're saying, but we know that a lot of preparation has been done, and we know the clock is ticking. But actually, what we know is dwarfed by the things we're still uncertain about. So by way of a massive cop-out, let me just go through four things I think that will ultimately determine where we end up without making any predictions, because I'm never ever doing that again in my life. Unless it's football, and then I'm wrong anyway. So the first thing we don't know is how long we're going to have this Prime Minister for. And I actually, and Jonathan and I were talking about this earlier, I think she will last for far longer than most people seem to assume, simply because the Conservatives are so weak they can't afford to look any weaker by getting rid of her. I think if she'd come out of this election with a majority of 20, she'd be gone by now, because actually that would have been workable. I think because she's weak, she's actually harder to replace. But if she goes, it means two things. One, what has been the most striking thing about the year since the referendum for me was the way Theresa May, by herself or with her two mates, defined what Brexit meant and didn't listen to any opposition. So she made the speech in which she said, Brexit quite obviously means we're out of the single market, we're out of the customs union. There's nothing at all obvious about that, but she said it, she got it through, she got the Article 50 vote. The ease with which she determined the outcome she wanted was quite staggering. We get a new Prime Minister, they might have different ideas. And of course, if we have a change of leadership in the Conservative Party, you will see the mother of all fights over Europe break out in that party. So whether the Prime Minister stays is the first variable. The second variable is how MPs behave. There's been a lot of stuff said over the last few weeks about, oh, there's an overwhelming majority for a soft Brexit in Parliament. But do you remember last June when everyone was saying, yeah, we voted to leave, but there's an overwhelming majority in favour of remain in Parliament, so Parliament will find a way around this. And then what happened? Parliament voted overwhelmingly with its massive majority in favour of remain for triggering Article 50. Just because MPs are thought to believe something or indeed do believe something, it's not necessarily the way they're going to vote. It's going to depend on a lot of things. It's going to depend on the dynamics within the parties, how well the whips can keep discipline on both sides, both Labour and Tory, and the dynamics between the parties. My suspicion is that Labour will go back to the days of John Smith, which is our policy on Europe is we don't have one, but we disagree whatever the government does. That works well in the short term. It worked brilliantly in the election, up to a point. But whether they can maintain discipline amongst their ranks, when Keir Starmer is already quite clearly saying different things to John McDonnell, is very, very hard to say. So how Parliament behaves is the second variable. The third variable is the economy. What happens to the economy? Now, the most helpful piece of analysis for the Leave cause now was the short-term Treasury forecast published in April. Why? Because it was wrong. It was fundamentally wrong in virtually everything it said. So before the referendum, the Treasury published a short-term report saying if we leave the European Union, in the year following that decision, we will lose 500,000 jobs and there will be a recession. Wrong and wrong. And so now, whenever people warn of economic trouble ahead, what the Brexit side say is, yeah, but they're wrong. Okay. Now, if the economy starts to show signs of deterioration that hits people, if inflation goes up further, if you get decreases in investment, if you get job losses, and this is the fundamental thing, someone comes up with a compelling narrative that links that to Brexit and not to something else, you might see the debate about Brexit shifting. At the moment, I don't think you will. At the moment, I remain convinced that we will leave the European Union, and I remain convinced, actually, for that matter, that unless public opinion shifts dramatically, which I'll talk about in a sec, we should leave the European Union. But a lot will hinge on the economy. And let me finish on public opinion. YouGov do a tracking poll on attitudes towards Brexit, and it's the most amazing thing. They do a graph. Do you think leaving the European Union was a good idea or a bad idea? Okay. And the graph that they've done since the referendum show two parallel lines. The people who think it's a good idea, the people who think it's a bad idea. 52% generally think it's a good idea, 48% generally think it's a bad idea. You remember those numbers, they're very, very similar to another set of numbers, okay? Those numbers have wobbled a little bit in the last 3 or 4 weeks. So they've almost swapped sides, so it's almost 52-48 the other way. If you see public opinion shift dramatically, then that in turn will affect the way that MPs behave inside the Palace of Westminster. At the moment, there is virtually none, in fact, probably none, there is no sign of the buyer's remorse that everyone's been talking about. People who voted to leave genuinely seem to think they voted the right way. People who voted to remain think they voted the right way. And so those are the four areas to watch. I have no earthly clue how they're going to develop over time. Things will become clearer as we go, though bear in mind one thing. As things become clearer, the clock will be running down. And as the clock runs down, we need to get some sort of deal, because if we fall out with no sort of agreement, particularly on the Article 50 stuff, the short-term impact will be very severe.
Thank you. I think entirely gratuitously I'm going to hold room ballots after every speaker, but I might not be able to live up to this, but I will ask you a question. I mean, let's establish the baseline. I think RSA fellows are probably about 85-15 or 90-10 remainers, so the room's probably a little bit in that way inclined. But let's just first question. People may not want to do this anyway, but has anyone in the room, you don't have to tell us what you've changed your mind, in which way you've changed your mind, but has anyone in the room changed their mind on the position which they had a year ago on Brexit? One, two, three, four. So that's kind of pretty typical, four out of about 160.
That's actually pretty good.
Or only four who are willing to be honest. Ah, yes. Gina, over to you.
Good afternoon, and thank you for inviting me. Leading on from Anand's speech, I absolutely agree with everything he said, but I just want to add a few other dimensions. First of all, domestically, we need to wait to see what will happen with the vote on the Queen's speech next week. Because if that Queen's speech is voted down, the last time that happened was 1924, it will be very difficult for this government to get those 24 measures and 8 bills on Brexit through Parliament. If they do not have a deal with the DUP, that will also have impact with them getting legislation through Parliament. By the way, just I want to touch on something about the DUP, which I'm astonished that nobody is talking about, which is a Barnett formula, because you've got hard-headed negotiators wanting their £2.5 billion. If you then apply that formula to the other devolved powers, that's Wales getting about £3 billion, Scotland getting about £8 to 9 billion. That means the EU taxpayer for those 10 seats are going to end up with a bill of something around £13 billion. Just think about that as we go into Brexit. But getting back to Brexit for a moment, so we then don't have a government that can get legislation through, much less negotiations. The House of Lords are going to be very strong in their scrutiny They have already expressed so. And then you have the other parties behind the scenes that we know have met, Labour, Liberals, SNP, who are going to put an amendment to the Queen's speech, which will be around access to the single market. So there's an awful lot that can happen in the space of a week. That's even before we start negotiating. And what's happening in the meantime? In the meantime, the 27 member states, their presidents and leaders, are meeting this evening. And after dinner, the UK will not be at the table. And their discussions will be about the Brexit negotiation stance. It will be about them carving up the EMA, the European Medical Association, and the EBA, the European Banking Association. Those talks will happen later this evening, 10:30 UK time, and we are not at the table. So that's just the start. They have already, before we even exit our or settle the divorce bill and start proper negotiations after the German elections in October, they have already drawn up their draft negotiated package and have more or less agreed all their red lines. So there is very little room for manoeuvre. So what is it that I think can practically be done? I absolutely agree that Brexit is Brexit because we lost the vote, and that's what we have as a democratic country. I don't believe in any of these adjectives that are added, red, white, blue, high, low, soft, hard. It will be the deal we get, and we have to push for the best possible deal. But that will be the deal we're offered. I would like to see the government and politicians, RSA, institutions, corporates, start talking about the pros and cons of the deal that we are most likely to get, what the WTO option means, and what remaining and reforming and being part of the reform agenda of the EU means. Because to me, those are the only logical positions that can be taken as we move forwards. Let us stop talking about what happened a year ago. We are a year on, and we are no clearer on any of the details, direction of travel, or any numbers. We don't know anything. We were supposed to in the Brexit election. And if you look, you track on social media. BuzzFeed have done a tracking of social media conversations. And none of the political parties talked about Brexit until 3 days before the election when the Conservatives started panicking. The conversations that happened on social media were primarily dominated by me and an organisation I called Best for Britain, because we asked very direct questions of the people that we were talking to. We asked, do you want the next government to oppose an extreme hard Brexit because that's what's in whatever is in the manifesto? Actually, more importantly, what is in the letter? Because remember, Barnier has said that is what they're going on, is what was in that Article 50 letter, which is leaving the single market and the customs union. They're not interested in how we're negotiating with each other and our conversations here. They're sticking to that letter. So do not be fooled by all the things we're being told here. Their stance is very direct. And the conversations when we were on the doorstep asking people and online, we had over 500,000 people come to our dashboard, was that they do not want the next government to leave the single market. And then when we asked direct questions about, do you want the next government to guarantee freedoms of travel, retiring, educating, 69% of the same poll that was used, but, you know, samples YouGov are using, said yes, and only 10% said no. The politicians and the media, we are not asking sensible, direct questions to the public. There's a lot of semantics about what the public thinks. I would like politicians to start asking the public direct questions, and for the public and organisations and corporates to be answering direct questions rather than the rhetoric we're still hearing, because it's not helping anyone. And I find this whole stance that we're taking very difficult to understand, because there's a madness that's descended here that seems to have gotten rid of all sorts of logic and everything we would do in our everyday lives as we go about our work, family, all those things that we would do as you'd leave a house, you know, look at a new house and you think, well, the report's just come back, it's not so great. I'll think again, or maybe negotiate again, or would I really leave? The common sense we apply to our everyday lives is absent when it comes to Brexit, and that's what worries me so much. But I am hopeful. I think we have time, and I'll just leave you with these thoughts. I think, and I've been pushing very hard for this from day one, that we should have a cross-party committee or delegation that goes, that reports back every 4 weeks, because that's when we'll be able to report back, that tells us honestly how the negotiations are going and how they're being reported. I would also like to see some modelling on the different scenarios. I'd like to see a white paper that actually does a proper the things that a white paper is supposed to do, not the empty rhetoric that we got in the last white paper. And I think we have time, because the negotiations, I said at the beginning of my a little talk, is not going to start in earnest till October. So I think we have got time to put those things in place. So I'm not completely hopeless that we won't get... And then we go for the deal, that the best deal we can get, and then we come back and have a parliament. And one of the... a vote in parliament. But the reason I would not leave it just up to one party or up just to the MPs is I invested and lost an awful lot in bringing my case. And the MPs just rubber-stamped and actually sold themselves out. So why would I trust them again? It's got to be cross-party. And I leave that.
Okay, second random non-scientific room poll. Put your hand up if you think there is likely to be a significant shift in public opinion against Brexit over the next couple of years. Put your hand up if you think that's going to happen. Interesting. Hands down. Put your hand up if you don't think that's going to happen, if opinions are going to shift, stay as they are. I think there might be a bit of wish fulfilment in that. But nevertheless, it's an interest...
What was your time scale?
2 years. That's an interesting prompt for Jonathan. Over to you.
Thank you, Matthew, very much indeed. Thank you for having me. I mean, can I ask the obvious question then? No, put your hand up if you voted for Brexit.
Yeah, told you. Okay. I did say.
So we've got about, I think, four people in an audience of over 100. So... No, the five of us are in quite a minority. And this is obviously where the Liberal Metropolitan League come on a Thursday lunchtime.
Thank you.
The referendum, as we know, was a year ago tomorrow. And referendums in this country are not used that regularly, but I think they're an important device to settle constitutional questions often, or indeed questions which divide political parties, where... And we saw that in 1975 with the original referendum on entering the common market. And so it was that we saw it again with the referendum last year, where, lest we forget, 17.4 million people voted to leave the European Union, which was more people than have ever voted for anyone or anything in British electoral history. And indeed, more than voted for any party at last week's or a couple of weeks ago's general election. And as far as I'm concerned, that referendum was very much a mandate from the British people seeking to take back control of our laws, of our money, of our borders, and our trade policy. And to do those things, that requires being outside the single market and being outside the customs union and outside the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice. You know, and don't take my word for that, because during the referendum campaign, David Cameron, George Osborne, Nick Clegg, and others all explicitly said, if you vote for this, we'll be outside the single market, we'll be outside the customs union, and indeed, that is what has to happen in order for Brexit to be meaningful. Obviously, there was the change of prime ministership after the referendum result, and the government under Theresa May has spent most of the last year preparing for the negotiations which have started just this week, with Article 50 having been invoked back in March, and that is the government obeying the people's instructions. And what you saw with the white paper, with the Lancaster House speech firstly, then the white paper from the government, was a very clear vision. I dispute Gina's suggestion that the government haven't been clear. I think they've been very clear about what Brexit will look like in terms of the institutions that we will no longer be part of, and the vision of having a friendly relations with our neighbours across the Channel, continuing to cooperate with our neighbours across the Channel on a whole range of issues where that is appropriate, but at the same time saying, you know, we are not going to be part of these institutions, we are not going to be channelling billions of pounds into the EU every year, And frankly, the British people said that they weren't happy with the situation as it was. As for the election that's just happened, I don't think that changes a great deal. I think despite the claims of some obstructionists who don't accept the vision of Brexit as the government have put forward, Brexit really actually wasn't a huge election issue. The issue was actually neutralised, wasn't it? Because, in effect, you had both major parties accepting the referendum result, saying that they would deliver Brexit. And more than that, you obviously had Labour and Conservatives, apart from a small number of rebels, as we said, triggering Article 50, the party saying they accepted the result. And 85% of voters at the general election voted for parties who were committed to delivering Brexit through being outside the single market, through being outside the customs union. The manifestos committed to that. Obviously, the Conservative one did. We all know that, and they're in government, and they're pursuing that agenda. But if you read the Labour manifesto, they were too. The Labour Party said freedom of movement will end on leaving the European Union. Freedom of movement is one of the four sacrosanct freedoms of the single market, as far as the European Union is concerned. No, they are not. You know, it is incompatible to end freedom of movement and remain in the single market. They were absolutely clear about that, therefore the single market membership had to come to an end. Similarly, the Labour manifesto talked about the kind of trade deals that will be negotiated after Brexit. You can only do those negotiations if you are not a member of the customs union and in control of your trade policy once again. So you had, as I say, a consensus between the Tories, Labour and, of course, UKIP and the DUP between them on that very agenda. And therefore, people at the election looked at a whole range of other issues and voted particular ways because of that. But I don't think Brexit was a defining issue. In as much as it was, the Liberal Democrats, the one party that specifically went out on a platform to represent the so-called 48%, which I think I'm right in saying Gina backed at the general election, they went backwards. They lost votes compared with 2015, as did the SNP, as did the Greens, who are also pushing an anti-Brexit agenda. And if you look at seats across the country, in the main, there was not an obvious pattern. You know, you look at a seat like Richmond Park, where you had the by-election just last year, defined by Brexit, where the Liberal Democrats won a 20,000 majority at the by-election. The election we've just had, the Brexiteer, Zach Goldsmith, for the Conservatives, won the seat back. Vauxhall, which has, the biggest Remain voting population of any seat in the entire country, but had a Brexit-supporting Labour MP in Kate Hoey, massive efforts by the Remain contingent to support the Lib Dems in that seat. Kate Hoey, the Brexiteer, got her biggest majority ever in that seat at the election. The blurb for the event today talked about, is there a regrexit phenomenon? I think Anand basically nailed it that there wasn't. In fact, the YouGov polling that came out just a week, 10 days ago, showed that now 70% of the British public want the government to get on with delivering Brexit, which has gone up a couple of percent since before the election. And the Remain voters who want the government to get on with Brexit now significantly outnumber the ones who don't. So there's a very small minority now of the public who want to stop the procedure from going on. We've talked a little bit about, you know, the notion of soft and hard Brexit, which I think are completely ridiculous terms. I don't accept that terminology. They're propaganda terms invented by people who don't like the result, who use the negatively loaded term hard to define Brexit, which is just Brexit, whereas what is being called by some soft Brexit, although the definition seems to change from week to week, is a way of saying non-Brexit, as far as I'm concerned. I hope that people who don't like the result will accept the result and will basically come round to trying to, if anything, help the efforts to secure the best possible deal within the parameters of what the government are proposing. As I said, I want to see friendly relations. I want to continue cooperating on things like security. We will continue buying and selling to each other after Brexit in the same way that we buy and sell from companies in countries where we are not currently in a political union, there's every reason that we should continue to participate in scientific research programmes, in things like Erasmus, the student exchange programme, which there are non-EU members already participating in, even though they are programmes run by the EU. Now, I don't want to have to fight the referendum again. I took the view that it was too centralised, too wasteful, too unaccountable, too undemocratic, and that's what the biggest majority of British people agree with me on. And actually, a lot of the EU leadership want to pursue a more integrationist agenda, and I think not having us there actually helps them do that because we won't be holding them back. I'm very confident about it. I think the British public voted for us to stand tall in the world on our own two feet while remaining very outward-looking, globalist, internationalist in our outlook. And I think there are good days ahead, albeit in the months of negotiation. There's clearly uncertainty, but the sooner that we can secure that deal and be free, the better.
Thank you. See, they may not agree, but at least they applaud.
Very polite.
That's the liberal elite for you. They're very polite. I'm going to ask two questions up here, but I'm going to ask you, panel, in response to be as brief as you can, because I really do want to bring in everyone to the room. And what I'm first going to do is I'm going to ask Jean and Jonathan, I'm asking you a question. I don't think you'll like the question. I think you'll want to say, I don't think the premise of the question is reasonable, but I'm still going to try to get you to answer it, and I'm going to ask Arnaud to comment on the answers that they're going to give. So, Jean, the first question to you, Jean, is... It seems to be the intellectual weakness of your position is a kind of, in a way, what you're arguing for is that there's a kind of collective false consciousness going on, and that if only people really understood, really, really, really understood, then they would change their mind. And in a sense, there's a circularity to that, because if they don't change their mind, it just proves to you that they don't really understand, and they just you just need to carry on until some point at which you will know they understand, because when they understand, they'll agree with you. Is that totally unfair?
Complete nonsense.
Okay, fine. I told you wouldn't like the question, but...
Well, no.
But you are arguing if people knew more, their view would change.
No, I've said that we are moving forwards and we need to know the options. What's wrong with that? That's just pure logic and common sense.
But isn't...
It's not...
Isn't it your instinct that if people knew more, their view would change?
No.
No.
I think people have the right to make a choice that's an informed choice. Because if we end up with a fantastic deal and we do manage to get a modified... Look, we should all, which I've said over and over again, and if anybody actually bothers to listen to what I say, is that we are all Brexiteers now, and some of this conversation should have been had the day after, not now. We should be looking forwards. There's no point going back and talking about, you know, if we should leave, remain, and all these sorts of terms. They're not helpful to anybody. We should just be looking at the best possible deal we can get. If not, what does WTO really mean? What does that really mean? Because the WTO is not a vote, it's a consensual organisation. Explain to people what that means. And if you cannot, on a benchmark, limit the damage to an extent that will not be paid by the next generation, then people have the choice to think again. That is all I'm saying.
Okay. Let me ask an equally unpalatable question, Jonathan. If people's opinion did start to shift, if, let's say, in a year's time, it was kind of clearly now kind of 70-30 against Brexit, or for an incredibly soft Brexit, as it were. Do you think that shifts anything? Because, or are we in a position where we say, well, whatever happens, we're stuck with what we did a year ago, rather like someone kind of waking up in Las Vegas with a hangover, realising they've got engaged to someone they don't know and then deciding to spend the rest of their life with them? Not to express it in emotive terms.
I certainly don't
accept... Nor has that ever happened to me, I'd like to ask.
I certainly don't accept the Las Vegas analogy, but as I say, the reason that we have referendums in this country is in order to settle questions that, you know, aren't easily settled by elections, frankly. I think, you know, over a period of decades, the British public were let down in a sense, because there was a very cosy consensus amongst all the major political parties in favour of this European project when there is an increasing resistance to it from the British public. And so I think it was a very good thing that David Cameron asked the question in the referendum last year. I think it's a shame that he hadn't countenanced that the British public might give him the answer that he didn't want, because it meant that the government hadn't made any preparations for that option.
But can we just go back to the question? I know you don't think it's going to happen, but just let's just imagine it did. Let's just imagine we got to that kind of 75-25, 70-30 position. Does that, are politicians legitimately able to say, well, it looks like you've changed your mind? Or do you think, no, you have to say, no, you did it, and you've done it forever. It doesn't matter if it's 99%, 1%.
I don't think that's going to happen. And I think, you know, we're in a process of negotiation where we need to hold our nerve. And I am incredibly optimistic about the future outside the European Union. As was pointed out earlier, you know, the predictions of doom that were given to us by the Remain campaign during the referendum have all turned out to be complete, unadulterated nonsense.
Right, that's fine. I've got that. So, Anand, Gina says her strategy isn't really that if people could have more information, they might change their mind. And Jonathan kind of, I think, is saying, I don't need to worry about the question of public opinion shifts because a referendum's a referendum's a referendum. I'm just interested in your view. I mean, no, you're not impartial exactly, but I'm interested in your view of those answers.
Well, I mean, on the first one, I don't want to talk about Gina's position. I mean, there are people out there, you see them on Twitter, who do identify an informed choice as being the right choice, which is my choice. I mean, that's just how people argue. I find it's a very patronising and annoying argument, and I equally don't give much credence to the argument, well, look, this was a referendum that was run on lies, so it doesn't really count, as if elections were run on truths. This is just the way systems function. And it always has been. And so I don't particularly buy into that. I'd say two things that about the referendum. It was partly about the sort of dissatisfaction that Jonathan was talking about with the European Union. It was partly, and I think the liberal elite have been very, very slow to grasp this, it was a kind of two fingers to them. It was a sort of reaction to the fact that when Chancellor of the Exchequer stand up and say, what are you upset about, the economy's growing, people thought, well, my life is getting harder and you people have done nothing about it and the EU is part of that system that you praise and we want a different system. And for me, one of the fantastic things about the outcome of the referendum is people in London have realised that the north of the country exists. You know, our political priorities have shifted as a result of this referendum, and I hope and pray that that remains the case and that we end up, if nothing else, with a fairer economy, whatever happens to our economy because of Brexit. And that, for me, would make it all worthwhile, quite frankly. I mean, you hear that story about, from a mate of mine on the BBC was saying about 3 weeks after the referendum, he was sent to Hartlepool and he went out to Petra Express and he bumped into three other BBC correspondents who'd also been sent to Hartlepool to figure out what it was, you know. And, you know, that's a good thing. On the other point, I mean, I share the scepticism that it will happen. I suspect what will happen at that point is if you get a 70-30 the other way is you will see the behaviour in Parliament change. And you'll see that behaviour change very, very quickly indeed. And that is where the debate will play out because Parliament will be very, very sensitive to public opinion in the way that it actually was after the referendum. 70% of English and Welsh constituencies voted to leave the European Union. I think 70% of MPs voted to remain in the European Union. What did MPs do? They went with their constituencies. They didn't go with how they voted in the referendum. And I think you'll see that again. Bear in mind that the old, you know, insofar as, and we are never certain about this, but the economists say that it is when the trade barriers are erected that the economy will suffer, and that is when public opinion might shift. So most academic economists, no academic economist made a short-term prediction about the effect of Brexit. They all made long-term predictions, and as far as they're concerned, those long-term predictions remain the same.
You started to answer this question, but just to continue it. In 5 years, one way or another, this will be settled, maybe 3 years, I don't know. What do you think the long-term impact is on the kind of will be on the political culture of Britain? I mean, in a way, the last election's intriguing, because on the one hand, it wasn't about Brexit. On the other hand, it clearly was. It wasn't about Brexit in terms of the content of the campaign, but it was about Brexit in terms of people's behaviours and the kind of cultural shift. So you've hinted at that a bit. You've said one good effect is that we might have more fairness. We might care more about those people who are so angry they voted against the elite as well as voting, you know, for freedom, as it were. What other effects do you think? Will we all return to normal in a few years' time? I mean, you know, after all, in the last election, we returned to two-party politics, which everyone was happily saying 5 years ago was dead.
Well, we returned to two-party politics with a minority government, which is far from normal. So there is no normal anymore. What I would say, I mean, 3 years is awfully optimistic, and this isn't a comment about whether Brexit is good or bad, but Brexit, particularly if it's a Brexit that sees us outside the customs union and outside the single market, and you can see ways in which that would work well, but what it will require is for us to completely rewrite our political economy from top to bottom. That's not a three-year job. That's a 10-year job. So we are going to be in flux for that period while we adapt to the fact that we're going to have to change our trade patterns, while we adapt to the fact that actually we're going to have to increase skill levels in the population to fill holes. At the end of those 10 years, I don't know, I haven't got a crystal ball, I don't know where we'll be, but it's going to be a process of, I know this sounds very sort of Trotsky-like, continual adaptation to cope with the impact of Brexit. And it might well be that we come out of this actually a more self-sufficient, a more liberated, a country that where politicians have to take responsibility for their own decisions and they can't blame Brussels for them, which I think might be a healthy thing, actually. But it's going to be far, far longer than your three-year time horizon, and it's going to involve an awful lot of churn at all levels, whether for society, the economy, or politics.
I guess for the 3 years, I just meant that I meant the debate about Brexit itself, not the consequences of it. Jonathan, there are all sorts of rather surprising things that have happened since Brexit. You know, the election, the mobilisation of people is one of them. But another one is, it seems the more we talk about leaving the European Union, the more we seem to want to be more European ourselves, you know, more inclusive, more social democratic. I understand that the Prime Minister has appointed someone to even do a review of whether or not our employment regulation is strong enough. That's a kind of irony, isn't it, that we seem to be becoming more Christian Democrat, or social democrat, Christian Democrat as a country at the same time as we're trying to leave the social democrat, Christian Democrat bloc.
I mean, certainly in terms of if you look at the manifesto that the Conservative Party put forward, I think a lot of that could probably be characterised as a kind of more Christian Democratic kind of, you know, industrial strategies and so on and so forth as a kind of party platform. There is no linkage necessarily between that and Brexit. I think, you know, the beauty of Brexit is that, you know, political parties will be free in this country to choose exactly what agenda they want to pursue. And as Anand says, you know, they will not be able to blame Brussels that they have to do X or they can't do Y, because sovereignty will be back in the House of Commons. I was on television yesterday with Chuka Amuna, the Labour MP, and he was getting excited about there being a golden age of Parliament coming up over the coming months because of the minority government and the hung Parliament and so on, and the scrutiny that's going to happen. And I said, well, that's all very well. Actually, the golden age of Parliament will be when Parliament actually gets to decide British laws once again, because at the moment there's huge swathes of legislation over which they have absolutely no control whatsoever. And this comes back, this is the point taking us back to the referendum, I suppose, where people on the Remain side were, you know, completely downplaying the impact of Brussels regulation and laws and so on our way of life in this country, saying, oh, you massively overestimate how much law comes from Brussels. And yet now we're being told that this is such a massive job to transfer from being in the European Union to out of the European Union, because there is indeed so much that Brussels has been controlling for so long. You know, there's an irony in that, isn't there? I think.
And Gina, one of the other things that's, I guess, interesting about this is that in many ways, the people who are Remainers regret the entire thing, the vote and all of that. But yet,
but most of them don't.
Well, no, but I mean, activists, Remain activists. But yet, we got a surge in participation in the referendum. We had another surge in participation in the general election. It feels like the country. I've never, you know, you do. I actually did pass someone in the street this morning talking about Brexit. You know, just ordinary people. You know, and. You know, taxi drivers talk to you about it, etc. There seems to be a kind of interest in politics, which I can't.
Question. It's amazing. I think it's absolutely, phenomenal. People talking about constitutional law, young people actually getting up and using their voice and their vote, which, if they had, actually, the referendum might have been a slightly different matter. But anyway, and women, because, you know, there were over 200,000 more women, because women have not been good at turning out and voting and getting involved in referenda, particularly. So I think it's to set that habit young, where people realise that politics doesn't happen to them, they are part of politics and it's part of their way of life, is fantastic. And I think it's really exciting that we've got more people who are so interested. Where they get their information from, though, worries me, because of this ghettoising of the minds that happens with social media, where you choose media that just confirms your point of view, rather than actually exploring all sides of an argument and having a much more prismatic approach to problems and problem solving. That does concern me, because I mean, that's not doesn't appear to be the world we live in at the moment. So there's good and bad in both of that.
Do you think we've reached a new level of political engagement?
No, I think we have, and also because there are deep-seated problems that are affecting everyone's lives. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are actually, the one thing that's not talked about is a hangover of the financial crisis. A lot of this, because the people who did do well were a very small minority, and the rest of the country haven't. So we have got a hangover from that crisis that has not been addressed by successive governments or politicians. So they have their part to play. But I think the fact that we've got so many people involved in politics, I speak to 14-year-olds, 16-year-olds, you know, Oxford, I'm going around the country, and they are the most engaged. Some questions are better than any journalist question I ever get asked. I mean, these are 14, 15, and they're so involved, and I think that's just so exciting.
So what I'm going to do is take a whole set of kind of questions or comments over the next few minutes and then invite the panel to come back and just pick one or two. Then do tell us your name, if you can, as well.
Thank you. My name is Tiki Martel, and thank you for your presentation. I tried to follow, and I don't understand a word. I couldn't follow. But I voted Brexit, and the reason is because I was watching the Greek tragedy and how the Greeks finally arrived to the conclusion that instead of sitting and milking money from the Union, they go back to basics again and start all over again. So I decided I pack a small suitcase and run. This is why I voted Brexit. But my question is it about a single market, or is it about wanting to become a United States of Europe? And this is how they, because work between the Europeans didn't work, and then the colonies didn't work, and for single power.
Nicholas Sanders. My concern has really been on education. The government wanted to reduce the amount spent on education, when if we have to reskill, we should be throwing money at education.
Okay, so that's a consequence of Brexit question. Then here.
Jenny Conway. I understood that a lot of the laws that we have to take back are laws that British people were very, very involved in creating in the first place in Europe. And the other issue I have something to say about is that it was only the politicians who said, you're going to have, the next year will be dreadful when we're coming out, etc. They weren't talking correctly. They really meant once we've left. But as Professor Menon has said, most really informed economists and political economists said that things would be very bad if we came out of the internal market and the customs union and so on. And people didn't really understand, I didn't understand, and I'm quite well informed what customs union was and so on.
Hi, Kevin Jones. One comment and one question. Comment is that there was an article in The Economist a few weeks ago that showed that the EU was not even in the top 10 issues for most of the population in the run-up to the referendum. It only became an issue once the referendum was announced, and I think that's really quite interesting and quite important. The second is that every day, if I pick up the paper, there is an industry out there that is saying that it's going to suffer if we leave the EU and we leave the customs union. This morning it was fruit picking and agriculture. Yesterday it was car industry. So I'd like a sort of response in terms of how are we going to handle being outside the single market, because it does look like it's going to have an impact on a lot of sectors.
Yeah, Tim Murphy, two questions to ask. Jonathan Isabey said referendum, that's it. Once you voted in a referendum, no going back. Well, we voted in a referendum to stay in 74 or to go in. Why is it that we can't have another referendum to reconsider now? Secondly, Professor Menon said that most parliamentarians, which I believe is true, would, if given a vote today, vote to stay in the European Union. Why is it that we're not prepared to leave parliamentarians to take the decisions for us? Otherwise, perhaps we'd be having capital punishment, for example, back again.
And then behind you,
Rob Hull.
Hi, Rob.
Taking your 70-30 scenario, what's the point of no return? What is the point at which we could not reverse the decision because Brussels wouldn't let us? Is it April 19 or what?
Or has it happened?
Bien, Kelsov. Referendum gave clearly a mandate for Brexit of some kind, but Brexit consists of a lot of different components. And it can be argued that any judgment whether there is a clear mandate for, say, leaving the single market or restricting freedom of movement completely or seeking complete judicial or legislative independence, whether there is a mandate for that is an extrapolation from how the campaign went, what questions were asked, how people responded, opinion polls, and so on and so forth. Now, it could be argued that there is actually a need to clarify mandate on individual issues, and I think it might be a question for Gina, because you said we should be asking, government should be asking explicit, precise questions. I'm curious how you think that might be achieved, the actual mechanics of this.
Giles Bailey. One of the kind of segments I don't often hear a lot about, which I'm interested in the panel's reaction to, are the, say, 20 to 25 to 30-year-olds who for the last 30 years as a generation had access to work in Europe. When they lose that, I'm just mystified that they won't actually be so appalled and that will actually create a reaction. Clearly, it might not happen in the first 3 years. But just kind of the panel's view of that cohort's just shock at their change in lifestyle.
Thank you. And then finally?
Nick, I didn't vote against for Brexit because I don't vote in this country, but I campaigned for it because although I'm European at heart, I'm against the EU as it is because it's broken and it's beyond repair because of this unanimity rule. For any tiny modification to be voted, it has to... It's always watered down until it's... That's why David Cameron couldn't negotiate anything. So I think it's good that we are out of it.
Very good. I think Jonathan may dine out on the fact he came to the RSA, and the two questions asked by Europeans were both anti-European Union points. So I've just worked out, by the way, Jonathan, if we wait for as long to have another referendum as we did between the first referendum and the second referendum, which is Rob's question, you'd have to concede a second referendum in 2058. I think you'd be willing to do that, wouldn't you? Probably. All right, so Jonathan, pick one or two of those.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, you know, obviously the 75 referendum, no one under the age of 57, I think, had voted in that, and clearly, you know, it was time long overdue to ask that question.
You said this referendum was permanent.
I wasn't wrong with you.
What?
Yeah.
You
will accept the possibility of another referendum in 2050 if Brexit doesn't work out. Yeah, he's giving you that.
Right. In terms of, you know, mandate for leaving the ECJ and the single market, as far as I'm concerned, that comes from my reading of the Conservative and Labour manifesto. That's pretty clear. Jenny, I think, was asking about how laws have been created by British people in the EU, but, you know, I don't care who created them. And actually, I want British people in the British Parliament to create British law. But what's significant about the repeal bill is that it will transpose every law that's currently in EU law into British law, and then British politicians can decide whether they want to keep them, reject them, or indeed add to them in some way, shape, or form. No, there's a lot of nonsense said about suggesting that, you know, we're suddenly going to have no environmental regulations or no workers' rights in this country. Well, we are, because we're going to have exactly the ones that we've got at the moment, and we can then decide what we do with them and hold accountable the British politicians that we elect. Finally, there was a mention about Greece, and I was going to bring this up in relation to something that Gina said earlier about how, you know, if more young people had voted, the country would have voted Remain. You know, I look at the young people of Greece and indeed Spain and think how the European Union has consigned a whole generation to mass unemployment. And, you know, is that really the kind of caring, sharing European Union that the Remain campaign supposedly believe in? The way that the European Union forced those countries into the euro and when they absolutely weren't ready for it has caused, you know, unspeakably awful situation for literally millions of young people across the continent. That's the truth of how the EU has treated them.
Very good, thank you. Gina, I know you could speak a great length for all those questions, but just pick a couple of key points.
I'm going to pick the one on Article 50 and, you know, could you change your mind? And if not, that actually is not a question that the UK can answer, because it was never written for the UK. It was written for any member state. And that question has never been clarified from a legal point of view. Or the closest things we have is something called the Three Knights Opinion in the UK, which includes Lord Kerr, who was instrumental. He didn't write it. That's actually, he's instrumental in it, which says yes. And the EU itself has given indication that he believes so. But the only legal way of finding out the answer to that question and getting legal certainty is to ask the ECJ. And nobody has done that. And it's not necessarily up to the UK to ask that. The other thing about the EU, what I don't like about this argument and the way the referendum worked and all the way through and where we are now is that it's so binary. It's far too binary. What we're talking about, this idea of, you know, remain, leave, and we keep using old language and we're not confronting the issues that are facing us as we go forwards, rather than just looking back all the time. And yes, there are many things wrong with the EU. And that's a whole reason why we could have been there reforming it, rather than, which is actually what the EU so regrets, because we were the people at the table who could sit between the Franco-German motor that's possibly actually now going to look as though it will push reform. But we could have been there at the table. And to say that Cameron, he didn't ask and didn't push for hard enough. But these are all things in the past. It's how do we get through? I want to know all the things that Jonathan said. Where's the detail? How do we achieve it? Can we stop the rhetoric? How are we going to do this? Show me some evidence. Show me the plan. Show me the strategy. I still don't see anything.
And last, the final word.
Okay, there's no necessary reason why 25-year-olds will lose the right to work. It might become more difficult. We don't know yet. But let me just say something about this young people's vote thing, okay? We have an elderly population. So according to the survey data, it would have taken 120% of 18 to 25-year-olds to vote to swing the referendum the other way. It would have taken a 97% turnout from under 40s to swing the referendum the other way. So this notion that if they've only got out of bed and turned off Netflix for 30 seconds and gone and ticked a box, everything would have been different, just simply isn't true. The point of no return is March 2019. We don't know, as Gina said, what the European Court of Justice will say about whether we can change our minds. But I would say Lord Kerr has as much right to rule on this as anyone in this audience. He's not a judge in the European Court of Justice. If you listen to how he's quoted in the newspapers, you'd think he was. He isn't. He doesn't know. And finally, Jenny, UK shaping European Union laws was the first part of your question. Yeah, we were anecdotally, I think, quite effective inside the European Union at shaping legislation. At the same time, we had to deal with a common agricultural policy we hated from the start. We had to deal with a euro that was starting to impact on the City of London and over which we had virtually no say. So yes and no. There were still things about it that were happening that hurt our interest directly. And so it's...
But the workings of
the euro were having an impact, and debates over things like euro clearing in London and debates over the ultimate repository of regulatory authority in the European Central Bank were going to affect business in the city eventually. That was going to happen always. I mean, we might have been able to live with it, but that's a different point. And finally, customs union and the single market. It is very, very messy. What the economists say, and I'll leave you with what they say, I won't say whether they're right or wrong, is if we leave the customs union and the single market, they estimate it will, in the short to medium term, cut our trade with the European Union by 40%, which is an equivalent loss to our GDP of about 3%. Now, what Brexiters will say is, A, we'll have a trading deal, maybe we will, in which case those numbers will be lower, and B, we will have deals with other parts of the world that will make up for it, again, maybe we will. But on the simple question of the customs union and the single market, if we just left with nothing to replace them, it will be bad for our trade.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for your questions. Can I just ask you to thank our wonderful panel? Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.